We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
I'll tell you, I got a love-hate relationship with the desert. You know, I grew up in New England, four seasons, lush forests, mountains, ocean. And, you know, I've explored the desert here and there on family vacations and on trips with, you know, friends and whatnot. But in 2016, I was on a History Channel show that never aired. We filmed a full pilot in Baja. And, you know, I had this experience where I'm supposed to take this guy across the desert, and I'm pitted up against another subject matter expert, another survival instructor who later was on a couple Discovery Channel shows. Good guy, by the way. But I got to bring this guy across the desert, and I got to beat this other guy to this prize. So walking across the desert, and it's just kicking my ass. I mean, I'm not used to dry. I'm used to humid. I'm used to, again, boreal forest. So one of my fondest memories of that whole thing was at one point on the second night of this three-day trip, like 26 miles across the desert with limited resources, my contestant, he ends up puking, like puking bad. And one of the contestants or one of the directors pulls me aside and he's like, Kevin, tell us about it, right? And I'm like, hey, you know, I don't know this guy, you know, and his name is Joel. Good dude. I'm like, Joel. I was like, yeah, I don't know how he's going to do. Oh my God. You know, I'm sorry. His name was William. I'm screwing up. It's been a long day. So, he goes, I'm like, I don't know how Will's going to do it. And, the whole time I'm telling like my side of the story, like I feel bad about this guy. I start a rumbling in my stomach too. And I'm like, oh, this is bad. Right. Like, I can feel like I'm about to pop too. So the camera goes back over to Will and starts recording Will like, with his hands on his knees, like spitting and hawking loogies and things like that. And I just let it loose. And I'm there with my elbows on my knees and I'm yakking bad. And next thing I see are 2 feet in front of me. And I'm like, oh, those dirty sons of, you know what? I'm like, there's a camera. I know there's going to be a camera when I stand up. There's a camera. So I stand up, I wipe my mouth clear, and I'm like, that's over with. And I walk away and pretend like there's nothing. Meanwhile, I'm like, I'm dying inside. Like, I just spit up part of my soul. And I would not let them see me puke. And I could hear them in the background being like, what the hell was that? Like, who is this guy, right? So long story short, we complete the challenge. My guy wins. He wins like 10 grand. And the security guard that was with us, because both teams had a security guard and a medic, security guard that was with us, this big British SAS like commando, he comes up to me, he goes, gotta give it to you. He's like, you're one tough bastard. And I was like, oh my God, he likes me. the whole time I thought this guy wanted to kill me, because I just tend to be like super positive and this and that, and he apparently checked on me night after or hour after hour throughout that night. And he didn't think I was going to pull through. So luckily I did. So there I was.
So that's okay. You just heard him say the positivity, and that's the main thing. So we got Ski on the other end. He's at a different location today. The voice you hear is Kevin Estella, who is a former school teacher. We're going to get into what he's doing now. He is a subject matter expert when it comes to, to me, I say anything outdoors. I know nowadays it's like people use the term bushcraft or whatever. I grew up in that era of outdoors. We're running and playing in creeks. We're doing nothing organized. I was never into Boy Scouts, but it fascinates me the level of your knowledge. And so we were talking earlier, Ski and I actually were following you on Instagram and started talking about you. This is like, I don't know, maybe like 2 years ago, just about the content you were putting out and how positive it was. And at the time, I think you were still a school teacher, but not with Fieldcraft like you are now. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I just joined Fieldcraft in January 2021.
So if you can't like, so you know, too, like we've got a wide variety of listeners and a very large audience. So if you could kind of explain to everybody what Fieldcraft is and kind of what you do for that company.
Yeah, you got it. So Fieldcraft is a startup company started by Mike Glover. Mike Glover is a former Green Beret, former CIA ground branch operator, total badass, good guy. I always say that he is the other half Asian 42-year-old, 6-foot-tall dude that works at Fieldcraft. You know, just not as good looking. So that company, Fieldcraft, that I work for, we are a civilian preparedness company, right? We want to equip civilians with the gear that they need for their worst case scenario. We want to train them in navigation, survival skills, tactics, and self-defense techniques, mobility, right, driving. And then we also want to just educate them, continue to educate them over various media platforms. So that could be YouTube, our Instagram account. We have a Patreon account. We have a Locals account. And then all of our respective content providers have their own social media accounts as well. So we are there to help build community, better Americans that are capable to help one another in those worst case scenarios.
Yes. The cool thing like that, like, and for people hearing it, this is the best part about, at least to me, your message is not paranoia or conspiracy theorist. It, to me, it's more like, I would probably say a mental health break from computer screens, office work, you know, getting outdoors, but then starting to kind of master a little bit of the crafts and being able to just to get some, I don't know, like some breathe, you know, back into you, as opposed to just everything being so indoors. You know what I mean? Like that. And it doesn't matter about left, right, or any of that. Like, people just wanting to learn, I would assume. Right.
Yeah. If you think about it, like, years ago, if we talk about like the golden era of America, right? Like post-World War II, baby boomers are having babies like crazy. You know, the TV and media was used as recreation. It wasn't your 9-to-5 job, not at that time. And it seems like as we evolved as a society, we started getting away from being outdoors. And instead of being outdoors and using the television, maybe late at night just to watch the news as a family or together, it became like the television or the video game console or your smartphone became what you fixated on for 8 hours a day. And maybe you spent a little time with your family at night. So I feel like the content that we provide and the skills that we provide and the courses that we offer, it lets people get grounded to what's actually important, right? Learning how to do something awesome with your family, learning how to inspire your kids to avoid the habit of learned helplessness, which is so problematic in this country right now, where kids say, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. Well, we're going to show you that you can do some very difficult things. We're going to get you to a success level where your concept of difficult is going to be relative to everyone else's. You're going to say, this is difficult. Oh my God. You know, I can't fail with hardly anything and I survived and I had a badass time. I'm just going to say that, you know, what you guys consider as difficult is what I consider difficult. So our job is to really improve the quality of life that people have by giving them these really incredible experiences.
Yeah. I think we're getting to a point where just that innate instinct of just being outside and understanding what to do. We're like one generation away from losing all that with technology and like, just for a kid to just be able to start a fire. Right. And, you know, we got helicopter parents and just people are just scared of everything these days. And, you know, to me, that's basic. We all grew up in the 80s, right? We didn't have anything to do other than start burning stuff and build bike ramps, right? So, but kids now, they know how to start a fire on a game on their iPad, right? But you hand them a lighter and they're like, I don't even know what this thing is. It's like, well, flick it and there's a real flame there and it'll actually burn you if you touch it, right?
Or a magnifying glass.
Yeah. Start fires. Yeah. Burning ladybugs, though. But no, that's, I just think it's so cool what Fieldcraft stands for and what you guys are doing, because you're 100% right. And like, now's the time, right? And especially over the last few years, I feel like your classes had to just fill up, right?
If 2020 is an indication of what 2022 is going to be like, 2020, it was a bad summer, right? There were protests everywhere and we had the height of COVID and courses filled up. And this is before I was with Fieldcraft, but when I was still running my own operation back in Connecticut, I was selling up classes and people wanted to be outside. They wanted to just get out and, you know, we socially distanced and we did all that stuff. But I think 2022, if we look at 2020 as our indicator, 2022 is going to be nonstop. I mean, this past weekend, I just taught a group of 12, and then I had three other guests. So I had 15 students in a wilderness survival class with an overnight, and everyone had a blast. I mean, we roasted a deer leg, and like you said, we got to build fires. And, you know, it's not just kids that the kids aren't the only ones that don't know how to build stuff. Like, adults have lost that understanding of what it's like, because there are too many conveniences out there, too many products that are like, oh, here's Ready Fire, and it's like a Tinder that's perfect. This right. weekend, I took a totally different approach. I'm like, all right, guys, this is Tinder. This is the easy way, but we're not doing it the easy way. And I showed them how to find things off the land that they could spark and get a fire going. And, you know, I'll tell you, it was super rewarding. And when we did our after action report, and I went around the class, everyone was like, I loved knowing that I could do more with less. And that's my freaking mission in life. Show you how you can be super resourceful with limited resources.
And are you starting to get a whole bunch of different backgrounds showing up to your classes?
Oh, yeah. You would think like a military-owned company, right? A lot of high-profile military guys. We've got guys like Kevin Owens, who you know, won the international sniper competition, and like career, you know, military SF guy. You would think that we'd have a whole bunch of folks that just want to be like military guys, but we're getting folks that are showing up that look like they would be out of Portland, you know, protesting, you know, and we got folks from all different walks of life, you know. And it's funny when you have an expectation of who you think is going to be in the class, and then the class shows up and it looks like just the random jury pool of, you know, the soccer mom, the NASCAR dad, and the one random cop. And then the kid that, you know, was an Eagle Scout, but he forgot all of his stuff. Like, it's such a hodgepodge of really, really cool individuals that show up. And we always say they show up as strangers, but they leave as friends, because they realize that they have so much in common through wanting to train outdoors.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the cool thing, too, is that it reduces people's anxiety. Like you're saying, if someone knows how to build a fire, if someone knows how to build like a lean-to or shelter, or you're showing someone, this is how you would drink water out in the, you know, you can't just always just drink whatever water you want to, or maybe you can if you're in a certain area or a certain region, you know. But just the whole idea of reducing that anxiety, getting back out to nature, understanding things, and like you said, maybe just a group of people enjoying it. But now when Ski mentioned something earlier about generations, you have a pretty interesting background when it comes to generations and how you first started hearing about survival and that sort of thing. If you could, I mean, if you don't mind telling people about your grandfather.
Yeah, so I'll never mind telling the story, because it's family legacy. It's great men that were before me who did incredible deeds. Japan invaded the Philippines in January of 1941. And my grandfather was very outspoken. Some would call him a troublemaker. In fact, my father even told me, he's like, look, you know, your grandfather did some things that weren't necessarily like the most PC. And I'm like, okay, I got it, Dad. But it doesn't replace the fact that he did something awesome, right? Like, he moved most of the town into the jungle, and they lived there from 1941 until 1945. My dad was only 2 years old at the time, and he grew up in a cave. And I tell that to people, and they're like, what? He grew up in a cave? And I'm like, yeah, he literally grew up in a cave. He contracted whooping cough at one point. He almost died. His brothers went out every single night, and they went fishing with lanterns in the nearby creek, and they evaded the Japanese for 4 years. So people are like, oh my God, like, you know, that's a crazy story. I'm like, well, now you know why, as a little kid, instead of reading your average, you know, storybook at night, my dad would tell me stories about living in the jungle, making spears, how my grandfather would take a .22 rifle shell and he would hollow it out and fill it up with a poison called DETA that he would use to kill bigger animals, and like wild stuff that just captured my imagination. Yeah. And that set me on the trajectory for the rest of my life. So as a kid, I was hiking with my dad. I was learning how to fish. I was learning firearm safety. You know, I think just like every kid that grew up in our generation, there were probably things that you told dad and things you didn't tell mom. My dad was like, okay, let's go get you that Crossman 760 air rifle, but we're going to run it in the house, and you're going to shoot it in the basement, but you're not going to do it when your mom's home. And if she is home, we'll knock on the door, so like she doesn't come down and find out that you have an air gun, because she'll lose her mind. So then that eventually evolved into me like wanting to do more, right? And it was a nonstop passion. When I found out that there was a thing called a survival book, I was like, I need to get one. So I got like the Army Survival Manual. And I started reading up books like crazy, reading the short novels by Arthur Roth. And just, I was so captivated by this concept of living off the land, survival and whatnot. I mean, it led to the teenage years, learning how to canoe and kayak and working at Eastern Mountain Sports. And then somewhere in my early 20s, I said, I want to formalize my outdoor education, right? I had taken some lessons here and there, but never at a dedicated survival school. And there was a stigma. Don't go to a survival school because, you know, there's survivalists and they're the bad ones that want to plot against America. I'm like, no, they're not. Like there are some survival schools that are, you know, bush hippies, you know, like they like walking around and being connected with the forest. And hey, if that's your thing, that's your thing, but they've got good skills. So I started training at Maine Primitive Skills School, Jack Mountain Bushcraft, owned by Michael Douglas and Tim Smith, respectively. But then I settled on the Wilderness Learning Center in upstate New York after meeting my late mentor, Marty. And Marty was a Vietnam veteran. Marty was an Army survival instructor and a civilian survival instructor. And he and I just hit it off. Like, we were just straight shooters. We both had common interests with cigars and coffee and things like that. And next thing you know, he's like, oh yeah, come on up to my class. I took his class. The year following, I was planning on doing his plant class. He goes, come back up for the basic class. I'm like, Marty, I already took it. He goes, no, you've got to come up for it. I'm like, okay, you're my friend. I'll come up. But the whole time between the first class and that second one, we had gone on camping trips with his wife and all of our friends. And he was like basically assessing me. And when I get to the next basic class, he goes, oh yeah, by the way, that's Kevin. He's my new instructor. And it was like, threw me right to the wall. So I taught survival skills up there for 2007 to 2012.
That's awesome. Put you on the spot, man. And he knew you were ready and you just went from there.
So yep.
That's cool. And so you said you became an instructor there, but your background, you were also a school teacher. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Some people don't believe that one because, right. You know, on Instagram, I post a lot of firearms and knives. And,
yeah.
I'll post up like mindset where it doesn't sound like your average history teacher, but you know, in 2006, I became a history teacher. My story education wise, went to Bristol Central High School. You know, the famous high school where Aaron Hernandez from the Patriots went. His family's awesome, by the way. Despite what happened to Aaron, his family's great, good people. But I went there, then I went to Fairfield U. 9/11 was my senior year in college, and I had planned on going to law school. I mean, I can be a total jerk when it comes to arguments because I'm just very logical. I don't get emotional, and I just crush people with just words, and I love it. Mm-hmm. So I had planned on going to law school, and then 9/11 happens, and I was like, well, do I want to interpret law or enforce it? So I thought about doing state police or federal law enforcement, and I couldn't make up my mind. So I was like, well, let me just continue with my education. So I went to Trinity College and I got my master's in American studies there. But along the way, I mean, struggling grad student, I needed a job where I could sit at a desk, do my reading or my writing and basically get paid for being like a babysitter. So I took my sister's advice, became a substitute teacher. And the first class I ever substitute taught was a kindergarten class. And I felt like Arnold in Kindergarten Cop. And he's like, shut up! Right, But then this little girl comes up to me and she goes, we'll listen to you if you read to us. And I was like, oh my God. Like my heart melted. So there I am reading a book and I've got all these kids' attention. And then, you know, here I am thinking like I'll never teach again. And they all made a card for me. And they're like, thank you for being our teacher. And I was like, all right, I'll give it a second shot. I go to the high school and then I start teaching at the high school, doing substitute stuff there. But I actually was teaching the content, following the lesson plans that the teachers would leave behind. And I was like, man, I actually like this material. Like, I haven't thought about being a teacher. So I went and I took the exit exam for being a teacher just to see if I knew it well enough. And I was like, well, if I could take the exit exam, I could probably pass the entrance one. I passed the exit exam with flying colors. And I'm like, oh, great. Easy. I'm going to become a teacher now. Then I found out I had to take the entrance exam that had math. And even though I'm half Asian, I am like the atypical Asian that's the worst at me. So I ended up passing the entrance exam. I had to do all my student teaching, all that stuff. And I became a teacher in 06. So regular year, taught at a high school. Anytime that there was a week off, winter break, I was teaching winter survival. Summer's off, I was on a week on, a week off, teaching up at the survival school, or 2 weeks on, 2 weeks off, that type of thing. But yeah, I was living in two different worlds at the time.
Mm-hmm. So you, and you taught, did you say history or social studies? What'd you say?
Social studies. So basically world history, U.S. history, geography and cultures, sociology, psychology, like anything that a history teacher or social studies teacher could be certified to teach. I taught with the exception of economics because, again, atypical Asian. I don't want to do math, man. You know.
Right. So when you're teaching high school, right? So you've got. Am I stealing your question, Ski? Or no?
No, I was gonna go back for a second, but go ahead.
I was just gonna ask if you had like stories of like when you're teaching high school and you see like the person in the I about said audience in the class. Who other people would be like, oh, that's like the punk rock kid or the skate kid or what people would be like, that's the throwaway. He's not going to be anybody. But then he graduates and goes on and does something, at least with his life. Do you have stories like that or just where?
Oh, my gosh. There are so many stories. I mean, I taught for 14 years, roughly 125 to 150 kids a year. And you think about that. I mean, we're talking over 1,000 kids, 1,000 stories that I have, you know, and I've got a folder. I've got a big box of folders from every year, feedback from every kid. And like, it's as a teacher, I will say this, they don't get paid enough. And I'll start off by saying during COVID, we had a lot of teachers that wanted to teach, but were told that they couldn't. And most of the teachers that are out there, just like any job, they have a good heart. And yes, there are some that are bad apples that'll ruin the reputation of the teaching profession. But teachers don't get into teaching to become multimillionaires. They do it because they want to improve the lives of kids. And it was so incredible to see a kid that you had freshman year end up as the valedictorian senior year. And then, like, I had one who I've maintained friendship with. He just graduated from the Air Force Academy. And in the Bristol Press, our local newspaper, you know, he could talk about any of his accomplishments when he was valedictorian. He said, I really want to thank Mr. Estella because he not only taught me in the classroom, he taught me how to be a damn good person. He didn't say damn good person. He said a good person, right? Life lessons. Yeah. Yeah. And that type of thing, man, like you can't pay for that type of satisfaction, right? Like you might make a lot of money or you might have a lot of time off in your job or you might, you know, really enjoy your job. Well, as a teacher, you're not making a lot of money, but you do get June, July, and August off. The satisfaction level is through the roof when something like that happens. But to your point about the skater kid or the gothic kid or whatever, there were a few kids that I saw at freshman orientation. And I'm like, oh, this kid is not going to, he's not going to succeed. He's going to rub me the wrong way or he's not going to like me. And he ended up being the most polite, like young gentleman, or the girl who, you know, when you see her, like she's all like over the top, like super energy. And you're like, oh my God, please slow down. And then she becomes, you know, National Honor Society and gets into like an Ivy League. And you're like, I am putting my foot in my mouth. Like I shouldn't have judged you. So there's something to be said about that.
Yeah, I had a art teacher. That's why I asked that. I had two things. I had an art teacher and an English teacher. And the English teacher was like one of the first times a teacher's ever been like, hey, you're not the biggest dumbass I've ever had in a class, right? So I always kept in touch with her. I had her in ninth grade English. And I stayed in touch with her probably up until, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago. But she said that was one of her things that she loved when students would give her feedback, positive or negative. But that she would always feel like she made a difference, which that's what I told her. I was like, well, you did, because it was English. And eventually I did a few articles and stuff and writing, love writing. But the reason I asked that too was the idea of you don't get paid a lot as a school teacher, but everybody often says, why would anybody nowadays want to be a school teacher? And it's almost like this negative cloud over it. Where I hate that because you became a school teacher because you found the power and in encouraging and that light bulb going off when people actually learn things, not necessarily like dates in history or things, but like why the cause and effect, why things happen when Japan, you know, invades and a family in the Philippines have to live in a cave. Like this, this is what happens when countries do this, you know, throughout history, and like how we can learn from it. But I do dig that. I think that's pretty cool. Ski, I think you had something
good. Yeah, BC and I both have a training background as well, and I think there's nothing cooler than teaching something that's transferable immediately, right? And you know, you have somebody take a 3-day class and you're getting an email or a phone call 2 days later like, hey, that thing you taught on day two, like I just did it and I succeeded. In your survival stuff that you're teaching, do you have any really cool stories of just the student success stories where you've taught something and literally, you know, it doesn't have to be immediately thereafter, but you get that email or phone call that says like, hey man, like what you taught, like this is what happened. This is my story.
One of the words that is really, really, I'll say special to me is the word mentor, right? Like I will tell you that I've had a couple great mentors, not including my father. I would say my father is my father, right? I mean, he was a mentor, but father first. But it's very, it still strikes me when people will say, you're my mentor. And I'm like, whoa, like, I am? You know, like I'm your mentor. You know, I do some dumb stuff sometimes still. And I don't feel like Yoda, but it's cool in this day and age when we have Instagram, we have the ability to message so quickly. And I mean, quicker than traditional email, which this generation will tell you is so slow. But I get pictures of people in their backyard with their kids, showing their kid a skill that I taught them the weekend before. Or someone will say, here's my pocket dump. And they have the exact same Swiss Army knife model that I carry, the exact same ferro rod that I carry. Like they're copying my loadout to a T. And I'm like, it's very flattering. And don't get me wrong, it's kind of a stroke to the ego, but I don't want you to be a clone of me. I don't want you to carry what I'm carrying just because I'm carrying it. If you like it, great. But find what works for you. And that was something that my mentor, Marty, would always stress upon all the students, including me. And he and I always disagreed on Glock versus revolver, right? But he was happy, but he was happy knowing that I carried a gun for self-defense, right? Like, mm-hmm. So that's one of my favorite things is when students will reach out and say, I didn't know I was capable of camping in the winter until I did a cooler camping trip with you. And I pushed myself to the limit in my backyard. Now I'm going to go to the nearby state park. And then eventually I want to take my family up to, you know, whether it's the Adirondacks or the Whites or, you know, to a different location. Like, it's pretty cool knowing that what I taught them didn't die there, that it kept growing. So that's
awesome. Well, so I have like our backyard is overtaken by domestic rabbits right now, like suburban rabbits. And we have a home garden and they're destroying it. But I think I need to teach my kid how to make some snares. But I don't think she's prepared for like the morning after. So I need to, she's young, man. She's only like 5, but they got to start her at some point. But I'm just thinking like, man, that'd be kind of fun.
So you just mentioned, you said Glocks or revolvers. So yeah. What is the argument?
Well, Marty was a Vietnam vet, and mm-hmm. in Vietnam, he always said that the revolver would always go bang. And mm-hmm. we never got to test this thing. He goes, Kev, I will bet you, you take your Glock, I'll take my revolver, we'll tie a string through it, and we'll pull it through a swamp, and we'll see which one goes off. And I knew that the Glock would do it. And it's like maybe out of respect, I never really pushed the issue with Marty because his understanding of automatics, like when he eventually passed, I saw the list of all the firearms that he eventually had, and he had some like horrible, horrible autos. So maybe like Jam-O-Matics, right?
Right.
but he never owned a Glock. So mm-hmm. I think his understanding of it was kind of limited. But he also was a creature of habit, and he carried a Smith & Wesson Model 60. I now own that gun. It was transferred. And I haven't shot it yet. It still smells like his leather shop. And it still has like, you know, all sorts of dirt from the field where the surrounding school was. But, you know, that was just the big argument. It was like, which one's more reliable? And it's like, Marty, Glock is known for reliability. And you have your 5 shots. I have my 16 and a standard 19. Yeah. So it was just one of those things. Like we just had a fun argument back and forth. And he would always say like generational stuff, right? Like Marty was 79 when he passed a couple years ago. And I was like basically like a quasi stepson to him. He would call me his ugly Filipino adopted son when we were together, like we're all over the place, and people would come up and they'd be like, "Man, dad is really rough on you." I'm like, "He's not really my dad." But the cool thing was, and it's tragic, but it's cool. Marty's son eventually passed away from lung cancer. He worked in Jersey as a guy who did salvage, right? And he breathed in a lot of stuff. So when Marty eventually passed, a lot of the guys that were close to Marty in my circle of friends, we said, we will never let a Father's Day go by without calling Marty, you know, and we will be his true adopted sons, you know? So that, I know that meant the world to him. And you know, that's something that I think people are forgetting today is like, don't forget to call your dads. Don't forget to spend time with your moms, you know?
And those people that, like you just said, like mentors, like they're like growing up, there were these men that usually were like my dad's drinking buddies, but they would, you know, put that wisdom on you at like 2 a.m, you know, when everybody's just sitting around. And I look back and think about it now, and I'm like, some of the best advice I got were, you know, or was, you know, advice I got from men who were not in my family and were not part of my life. Just, you know, interspersed, like they would come in, you know, that sort of thing. So I do like hearing stuff like that. That's pretty cool. I was just interested in the Glock versus revolver because I'm a huge revolver fan, and I'm actually under the age of, we'll say, 50. But I still love revolvers. But Ski, you had something?
I got one of each, man. I literally carry both firearms with me.
That's the
best of both worlds. No, what I was gonna say, and I'm glad you just brought the family tie back up. Have you and is your father still alive?
Yeah, my father is still alive. Actually, just last week, I took an emergency medical trip home because my mother was diagnosed with cancer. So I spent a lot of time with my mother, spent a lot of time with my dad over the course of 5 days. But the interesting thing about that, and I know you've got a question coming, but I'll just tell a quick story. In March, I did another emergency trip back home, and both of them were hospitalized at the time. My dad ended up becoming diabetic. He had sepsis. My mother was jaundiced. And, you know, nothing makes you understand your mortality than seeing your parents go, you know, seeing your parents get older. So, you know, my dad has made almost a full recovery. But the interesting thing about having aging and ailing parents, and this is something that podcast listeners should just know if you haven't experienced it yet, when you're a kid, they are the one that is acting like the adult taking care of a child. But when that child grows up, they become the adult and the parent is almost feeble, like a little child, and it's your turn to take care of them. So I had the greatest conversations with my dad, even though there was this, you know, dark cloud over our heads from my mother, you know, getting this diagnosis and not having a lot of time left. So, you know, I had conversations with my dad, like, "Dad, what was it like when your mother passed?" And getting that knowledge transfer was so vital. And then having the conversation, "Dad, what's it like when you pass?" And he's like, "Do not ever feel like you did not make us proud." You know, so like have those conversations now before you can't ask those questions and get an answer.
And that's amazing. That's awesome. It just reminds me of a recent conversation I just had. I won't get deep into it, but it was one of my buddy's fathers on his deathbed, you know, literally seconds before he passed away, looked him right in the eye and he said, "Hey man, there's nothing you can't do." And he said he carries that with him. And this is a guy that was on the brink of suicide and all that. And like, that's what keeps him going now. So it's just really cool for you to touch on that, man.
Yeah. I would say at times I tell a lot of stories about my mom growing up and raising us. She was a single parent, but she passed away a couple of years ago unexpectedly. She went on a cruise, came back, had this illness, and they were trying to figure it out. And we had probably about a week, and then she declined rapidly. So we were trying to get everybody in town to be like, "Listen, this is getting bad." And a buddy of mine who's like a very well-known tattoo artist, this guy, James Vaughn, he's an amazing artist. He's been on Ink Masters and stuff. I always talk about him. He was like an older brother growing up. And he could not make it into town because he lives outside of where we are. And so he's exchanging messages with him while I'm in the hospital. And I've been holding it together pretty well. You know, I can compartmentalize a lot of stuff from my background. And, man, he sends me a text and is like, you know, we call her Mama Sanders. You know, he's like, go in there and hold Mama Sanders' hand. Oh, I'm going to get choked up. He said, go in there and hold Mama Sanders' hand and just tell her, you know, that I love her and I wish that, that I could be there for her and how much she meant to me, you know. And, dude, I lost it right then. Just reading those words, I lost it just because of that. And I say that just so that people understand when I'm telling stories about my mom and I'm posting stuff about her, it's because of the effect she had on me as much as she had on multiple kids growing up. I mean, we were all skaters and not everybody was giving us a chance in life. So she was always very cool to everybody. And I saw it when we had her funeral. There was probably about 350 people there. I mean, including like the mayor and a bunch of other people that, you know, she was just one of those people. So I'm glad you brought that up because I've heard you talk about, you know, your father and your parents in the past and your generations and what you learned. That's why I always talk about her, man, because she was cool. And I want everybody to know out there, like Kevin just said, have those conversations with parents now, even if you're young, if you're 20, 25, do it, start having some serious conversations with your parents. If they're still alive, hopefully.
Man, you know, what's really cool is we talk about music a lot on this podcast and, at BC's mom's funeral, man, I heard, I think it was the Elvis Presley version of I Did It My Way, right?
Yeah.
I'll never forget that, man. It was so awesome. I was like, this is a funeral, but like people are laughing, people are smiling and that music, like that song just nailed it, man.
So this is the last story I'll tell.
How do we get on this topic? This is awesome.
This is a good one though, because Ski is on location at a beach and I just got back from the beach and the beach that I went to, my mom's ashes are actually in the ocean. So this was her thing. She was very pragmatic. She's like, son, we had this conversation, you know, way before she ever got sick. She's like, when my ass dies, cremate me and throw me out there in the ocean. Cause there's a certain beach we always go to every year. Right now, I am the person in my family that always followed the rules. So when my mom says this, immediately my dumb ass goes into, well, mom, there's kind of like some regulations and rules against like human ashes. I can't just dump them out there in the ocean. I probably have to get some type of permit. And she's like, God damn, Dudley, do right. Just for once, do what I tell you. You know? So my brother and I do it. We take her ashes out there late at night, right? And so we go out like knee deep in the water and we go to dump the ashes. And it's not quite like in the movies because the waves are coming in. And so, of course, the ashes they're going everywhere. Now we're holding this box, and he wants to keep half of them for another thing that he's got with his family and friends too. So as we come out of the water and we're sitting there, and we don't really know what to do or say, so we just like snap, man. We start crying, hugging each other, you know, and I mean it was pretty powerful. And then we stop, and this is just how my family is. We stop and go, dude, some cop's going to walk up and be like, this is the strangest coke deal I've ever seen. These guys have got like powder all over them and they're hugging and crying. Like, what is going on? So anyway, like Ski said, like my mom was funny like that. Our ceremonies, when she passed away, we were all laughing, telling stories. And that's what she said. She's like, I do not want a funeral. She's like, one, I want everybody and their damn brother to be at my funeral. And she's like, two, I want funny stories told and I want everybody to celebrate my life. So for people out there, it's okay when someone passes away to celebrate, tell stories. And that's how I keep her memory alive. I tell stories and post pictures from my childhood. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'll say something. Like my girlfriend, you know, she's been awesome throughout all this with like my mom getting sick and everything. And like, there have been a couple times where I've broken down and I've just cried like a baby. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, you know, I'm choked up. And she's like, you know, it is okay to cry. And I'm like,
right,
it is. I'm like, right. But I'm an ugly crier, man. You know, like,
yeah.
So I think that's another thing too. Like, there is a stigma, you know, if you cry over like falling down and getting like your knee scraped, okay, maybe we can make fun of you a little bit. But if it is someone who actually matters, you better be crying. Like, you know, you can only hold it in so much, and if you do hold it in, it just leads to just bad things. So let it out.
Yeah. And this is coming from a badass dude. So, I mean,
yeah, a dude who survives.
Floodgates are open now. No, so my question was, and this is a great segue. Have you ever visited the Philippines where your grandfather and your dad lived? Or do you know where that cave is?
Okay, so I'm glad you asked that because that has been a lifelong dream of mine to go there. And you have to understand a little bit of like the Filipino culture. You know, my dad was Spanish Filipino. He was a mestizo. My great grandfather came from Mallorca, Spain. So my dad was slightly lighter skinned than a lot of the other Filipinos. And just like in Mexico, there's, you know, a little bit of, I'd say, like internal racism within, you know, the country. Lighter skinned people are considered, you know, better, for lack of a better word. So my dad was like, if you go to the Philippines, chances are like you could probably get kidnapped. And like my dad painted this terrible picture of the Philippines. And then I asked him one year, I'm like, Dad, would you ever go? But if we don't have to go back to where you're from, but like just go to the city. He's like, oh, I'm sure you'd be fine. Don't worry. Just, you know, you could do that. So he painted this picture when I was a kid for me not to go there. And then he tells me later that I'd be fine if I go to the big city. But then recently my boss was like, Kev, if you had $100,000 in a media budget, what would you want to do? And I, without blinking an eye, I said to him, I'd split it. I would do an epic trip to Alaska where I recreate the hunting and fishing trip I did with a buddy of mine floating in the Arctic Circle in the Brooks Range. I said, but the other 50, I would go to the Philippines and I'd find the cave where my dad and my family survived. I said, I have an idea with local contacts how to get the land records from the 40s. They were on their property because it was a large plantation. And I have a very, very brief description of what the cave looked like, because it was at the base of a ravine with a creek at the bottom, and there's a false front to it. Well, there's only so many ravines and creeks on a given property. And I guarantee if I had a modern mapping system, which I'm sure in the industry I could get someone to help me with this, I bet I could find, and I know the jungle's thick as all hell, but I bet I could find through local sources a general idea of where that cave is. And I want to do an expedition to find it, because that's the full circle test of everything since I've been a kid. You know, my dad taught me these skills. We caught possums in the backyard with a stick and in a wooden box. Like, you know, I want to go there. Yeah. I want to go there and I want to try this stuff. Right. And, and with whether I find it or I don't, it's, I feel like it would be a necessary trip. My dad would not want to go. He's too old, he would say, and I wouldn't want his health to be affected by that trip just for the sake of media. But for me, it's not just about the media. It would be to fulfill a lifelong dream to find that story and figure out if there's anything left in that cave that could shed light into my understanding of how they lived.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that you're on the same thought I am, but man, what a cool documentary that would be if you brought a film crew. And I know it's a personal thing and you maybe not necessarily want it filmed, man, but dude, that would be such a cool thing to film and capture and just come full circle to where you are now.
Film it. And I want to watch it, because that story just about sheer survival and going, okay, that, you know, the Japanese army's coming. Like we know this is bad. Let's go. And they just live in a cave for four years?
41 till 45. We know that. And here's the interesting part, right? They weren't keeping accurate records of time, but it was after MacArthur returned. So that was in the summer of 45, and it was January of 41 that the Japanese invaded. You know, there are still other families in the Philippines. My family's not the only one that did this. There are families that lived out there, and there were some folks that decided that they were going to spend their final days out there. They didn't want to come back to society because they enjoyed living off the land even more.
Yeah. I would say if there's a way to put that in motion, I mean, I got like $5 or $10, I'll throw it your way, but I know you got resources. Like someone out there is like, yeah, we definitely need to make this happen. I mean, I watch documentaries anyway, but I mean, just the whole idea of that and how it's just like the resilience of people who are just saying, okay, look, we're still going to live. This is a family. This is how we're going to survive. And I think too, like you said, you know, for you, if you went there, you don't have maybe the traumatic memories that like your father would. I mean, I'm sure like that's his home and that's where he grew up, but some of that would all come back too. This, the fear of it and the, I don't know, the idea of it, but you had mentioned, you know, just trapping like possums and stuff like that. I mean, I don't have a great story other than I went to spend a weekend at my dad's one time and a mama possum had like 8 babies in the underpinning of his trailer. So we had to build a rabbit box and trap possums. It sounds terrible, but we did. And apparently, if you let the possums, like, I didn't know any better. So, like, I've called him at work, like, hey, we got one, maybe two in the box. He's like, all right, dump them out. Now, he didn't tell me go, like, 500 yards away from the trailer park and dump them. I just dump them right there at the driveway. And I guess little baby possums know what they're doing. They just come right back in the trailer. But anyway, that's my rabbit box. It was pretty cool to build a rabbit box, though, with my dad. My grandfather.
You're a true badass.
Yeah, my grandfather showed us how to build a rabbit box and then built it. Because when he was a kid, that's what they would do is catch possums. He grew up in the South and cook them. So he thought he had a rabbit one of the first days. He was like, whatever, 10 or 12 years old, reached in the rabbit box blindly, you know, didn't see, and a possum bit him in the web of his hand. And he would tell me, you know, he'd be like, no, look here, you know, when a possum bites you, they don't let go until the thunder strikes. And I didn't know what that meant. Or until you pull your old timer pocket knife out and cut the bottom of the jaw off of the possum, which is what he did.
Oh, anyway. Gosh, you just said the old timer knife. Like, that's right. Getting the knife made in the going. Like,
yeah, dude. Wow. Like, that's what he carried. He was a little kid. But, I mean, he had to cut the jaw off of off the possum. So, anyway, he's the one that taught us how to trap. But that's all I did, man. I'm not like you. I'm not running around the woods and can build traps and stuff. Like, I will say this while we're talking about traps. So, you've got a book. It's 101 Skills You Need to Survive in the Woods, right? So, I bought this book. Ski bought it. And I don't even think we ever really knew that we both had the book. So we just get to talking about it one day. Yeah. But for anybody listening, man, like I grew up looking, like reading Ranger Rick magazines and stuff mm-hmm. like that, you know. But this book is cool because do you take the pictures? Are you a photographer too or no? Or someone else take them?
I won't say I'm a professional photographer, but, you know, I did all the photography for that book. My niece was 12 years old at the time, and she did all the illustrations for the book. She's going to be graduating high school next year. So, you know, now she's even more talented and, you know,
right. That's what I was gonna say. The pictures, that's what I love about it is, I mean, reading about it and then going, cuz just built like a 4-prong fishing spear. You know what I mean? Like I don't know, dude, I nerd out on stuff like that. And I can only imagine if people are getting into this and taking classes or even just going out, and there's a huge movement apparently of like people just camping again and just getting back out to, like, not like being a bunch of dumbasses like we were around a bonfire in the middle of the woods somewhere, you know, and like 8 of my friends getting drunk on, I don't know, Pabst Blue Ribbon or something. I wasn't drinking. But anyway, the book, though, is phenomenal. That's one of the things that Ski and I always talk about, though, when it comes to your book.
I just love it because it's primal, man. I just got into bow hunting just a couple of years ago, and my first deer that I shot with a bow, man, it was just so cool because it did feel very like 1800s or something. You know, you got rifles and you can make it easy and you can shoot out to 500 yards with all the technology and stuff these days. But, man, to shoot a deer with a bow and it, like, you know, close proximity at 20 yards or less and then drop it, man, it's a cool feeling to say, man, like, I did that, you know, because there's a skill set that goes with it. There's a mindset that goes with it. And I just love how that just gets back to the roots. That whole book, man, just gets people back to that. I think I used the word earlier, like innate and just our primal instincts as humans.
Yeah. And I think the goal for me when I wrote that book was to make people have that feeling, right? Like, I still have the copy of How to Survive in the Woods by Bradford Angiers. I got it when I was like 14 years old. And I kind of used that book as my template. And I said, all right, it's heavy on words. It's light on diagrams. He didn't have any photos in that book. It was all diagrams. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to provide my publisher over 100,000 words. 101 skills, 100,000 words, done. Well, my publisher comes back to me and says, you have to cut it by a third. And I was like, what? And she goes, yeah, you know, if we publish this now, like it was originally slated to be like 192 pages. If we published it with 100,000 words, it would be close to 300. And they're like, we can't do that. And I'm like, oh my God. So I had to cut it back. And then I had to be very selective with photos. So, I mean, I know that people are going to criticize the book. And when someone was like, well, there's not enough photos. And I'm like, I'm good. Like,
well, hey, did the same person have like the world's biggest comic book collection or something? It's like, Dude, there are plenty of pictures in that book. That's one of the things I love. Like you just said, yeah. I can read it, but then visualize it.
So you teach a ton of technical skills, obviously, in the survival world. But talk about what if you have a class of people that have never been in that world, what are you teaching like the lay citizen when it comes to survival mindset? Because the technical skills are come, but man, there's a lot that goes on in your head too in order to achieve anything that you try and preach or teach.
Right. So there are a few things that I touch on every single class. Number one is backup plans, right? The backup plan is pace planning, primary, alternate, contingency, and emergency. And a lot of people just have one plan where they'll say, well, any plan is better than no plan. You know, you could have a plan to die. It's not a great plan, you know? So I would rather have them learn to have backup plans. I teach them that you want to be consistent with how you carry things and where you carry things, right? And we can talk about this from a survival perspective, combative perspective with pistols, blades, whatever. Like, you want to reach for your tool in the same spot every single time. Talk about building momentum from the moment you wake up, right? Like, are you going to let an alarm clock defeat you? Are you going to complain that you have to go to work? Because if you start your day off on that terrible mindset, you're going to carry that negativity and toxicity throughout the day. Right. Mindset wise, we talk about the PSYOC readiness formula, awareness, preparedness, and willingness. And that's the idea that you can be ready when you have all three, but you're not ready when you only have two. So aware and prepared, but not willing. There are examples of people that had tools on them and then they didn't save lives when they should have. There are people who are aware and willing, but not prepared. Flight 93. That's the one story that gives me goosebumps, because they knew they were going to die, but they were willing to fight and they prepared themselves and took the fight to the terrorists. And then there are examples of people who are prepared and willing, but not aware. And these are people who might be the most, you know, skilled martial artist or seasoned, experienced outdoorsman, but they decide to get super polluted with a bunch of booze. And now they don't even know what room they're in. You know what I mean? So I go over all of these in the first few minutes of the class. And I love it when students are like, you know, taking notes like crazy, because I'm bothering them in a good way, right? It's something that I'm saying is really, really bothering them. And they're hopefully going to make change. You know, I would always say like, all right, if you just want to carry a folding knife and one fire starter, you are willing to accept the consequences of trying to survive with just that. You know, like, you might think, oh, I'll use this throughout my normal day, but what if you needed that for an abnormal day, right? You should carry full-size tools or better equipment. Otherwise, you're willing to accept the consequences of carrying something just to say that you are, you know? So a lot of this these are truth bombs that I'm dropping on people. And I'm not trying to do it to make people feel bad, right? That's not my intention. My goal is for you to have that slight uncomfortable sensation, but then to go on your phone while I'm talking and buy stuff to be waiting for you once you get home, you know.
Absolutely. And yeah. I struggle with that, and maybe you can coach me a little bit here, but you know, we live in a day and time now, and I guess it's always been like this, but the more you know, the more you know, right? So I try and be prepared, like, you know, let's just talk about protecting your family, right? If you carry weapons and this and that. But then I'm going, all right, well, I only have one tourniquet. Like, what if I need three tourniquets? And like, at what point do you draw the line and not drive yourself absolutely crazy, right? You know, I have a first aid kit, a tourniquet, a firearm, and I'm prepared to use all that stuff. But then it's like, all right, well, I might need three tourniquets if I roll up on a bad car wreck and I only have one tourniquet. And had I spent $30 more, I could have two. And, you know, then I start thinking about all the stuff. And, you know, you're talking about just being prepared for every situation. You can literally drive yourself crazy.
Right. And the motto that we had at the Wilderness Learning Center, where I worked with Marty, was always prepared, prepared always. Mm. You know, it was the idea that with like a core set of knowledge and a way of thinking, right? I'm not going to tell you what to think, but I'm going to teach you how. Wow. You will learn to assess possibility and probability. Is it possible that the aliens come down, like, you know, from, let's see, let's give a good movie reference. Independence Day pre Chris Rock slap. Is it possible that, you know, aliens come down and we have to run for the hills? Yeah, it's possible. Is it probable? Not really. I mean, even though the Senate hearings are pretty awesome, hearing that, you know, pilots are seeing them all the time. You know, so it can drive you crazy. right? It can definitely drive you nuts. It can make you paranoid, but you have to be able to rein that back in. You got to be controlled because, I mean, you can spend your entire life savings on preparing for the worst case scenario, but by doing that, you might not see the best things happening in front of your eyes, right? Like you might spend all your time in your bunker at home, reloading ammo and doing all sorts of crazy stuff. And I'm not saying reloading to crazy, but I'm just saying like you might just be focusing on the negative. Meanwhile, your kid is upstairs and just shot his first successful free throw. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
Make a balance preparing for the worst case scenario with living a good life.
That's very helpful too. And I just, if other people that are listening, you know, worry about that. Cause like, you know, when I look at somebody like you, and I read the book, as a grown man, I feel unprepared for a lot of things and it sucks to feel that way.
But don't do that. And I've said this year after year. Teddy Roosevelt, one of my favorite presidents of all time, said, comparison is the thief of joy, right? I can look at someone high profile and I could say, wow, they live a great life. Wow, they have, you know, all the time in the world. They go on these vacations. They have money. They have this. They have that. Like, and I could look at my life and say, I don't have that. And it will drive me to an early grave. If I'm comparing myself to other people, it's unfair to me and the life that I'm living, right? I'm living a good life by my standards. I'm happy. I'm healthy. I have good people around me. And I know that it's very easy to say, well, I could never be like that. And I know it's easy to say like my skill will never be like that person. Well, it doesn't have to be like that person's overnight, but work towards it every single day and be happy with those incremental improvements every single day. You know, be disappointed in yourself if you pass up an opportunity to be better, you know, and whether that's, you know, doing extra push-ups or reading an extra chapter in a book or reading up on an edible or medicinal plant in a couple older books or calling up a friend, and that sensation of talking to an old buddy makes you feel good. Like if you don't take advantage of every single day, you failed.
That's amazing advice. And another cool thing I was going to point out before I forget. So Fieldcraft, you guys are really broadening your horizon and trying to bring in all these teachers. I love the fact that you got some awesome female instructors that and they're doing all women classes. Are you seeing a lot more influx of women really getting into the survival mindset and starting to take stuff into their own hands and not being dependent on men to do things that traditionally men would do?
Yeah, I'll tell you. We have a gal in our North Carolina training division, Kirsten. Kirsten's a former SWAT cop. She's like 5'2". Her husband is a massive guy. He's the nicest guy in the world. But Kirsten is a pit bull, you know? And it's funny because a lot of females, they tend to look at training as like a man's domain, right? Like you're dealing with tools that make loud explosions only a couple feet in front of your face. Some of them require, you know, more strength to like rack the slide and things like that. And we are our own worst enemy when it comes to inviting women into the firearms world, because many times we don't think about how they carry things, right? Like women wear a lot of pants without belts. Mm-hmm. We tend to wear pants with belts because men have straight hips, right? So we're seeing now, and we've been very sensitive to this as a training company, that a class that is dedicated just to women needs to have some very women specific content in it. And if we can find these trainers like Kirsten, oh my gosh, it's powerful, because women will see these other women and be like, if she can do that, I can do that, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, over the years, you know, I don't fancy myself as a firearms instructor. Like that's not my role in the company. I'll teach a hunting class. I'll teach a shotgun class because these are the tools I use as an outdoorsman. But we have better sources as a company for learning to use ARs and doing combative pistol and stuff like that. But I'll tell you, when I have taught females how to shoot, they often outshoot the men that they're with. And I love it because we're our own worst enemy, and guys have so many bad habits and we're stubborn and we know it all. And women, they remember every detail. Like you don't have to remind a female, okay, sight picture, trigger press, slow, you know, like, they do those steps all the time. And men are like, I know what I'm doing. And they're slapping the trigger or, you know.
Yeah, that, Yeah, that's what I'll say. The because they don't have the insecurities rattling around in their head or the egos. When I was a kid, my dad was trying to buy us Uzis when I was in second grade from a guy he worked with. He worked in a beer business. The deal fell through, but we got Ruger 1022s instead. Now I'm pretty sure that shooting Uzi would have been better, but we got these Rugers. And my dad had told us, you know, he had married this woman and she had two daughters, and they were stepdaughter or stepsister is like 2 weeks younger than me. So we're very close in age. And my dad's like, don't worry, we're going to get out here. We're going to go over how we're going to shoot these rifles. He's like, it's not a competition. I just want you to shoot and have fun. Well, we get out, and he was smart because my brother and I are, you know, competing against each other. We got there to shoot, and she listened to every little thing he said, to the point where he's like, when this rifle goes off, it's not going to kick real hard, but it should surprise you a little bit, and that means you're going to be on target, right? Well, we're over there, you know, listening to our own stupid inner voices and missing the hell out of every target, and she's just like dead eyeing every one. And of course, like, that was my first lesson in, there really is no difference. It's who's going to listen and who's going to actually apply what they learn when it comes to firearms. So when you say that, like, that, and that's true. Like you had mentioned, that instructor has a SWAT background. That's like the coolest thing about being a cop in this era is I've worked for multiple female supervisors, SWAT, female SWAT operators, K-9, drugs and vice. Like, the cool thing is, it doesn't matter. Last 20, 30 years, if you're squared away, you're squared away. You know, there are plenty of firearms instructors out there too that are females that are amazing.
I got another good question, man. So a lot of, we've just been on the topic, and it's such a broad topic, but what are some little bits and pieces of advice you can give anybody that's listening to this and how to take that first step in starting to prepare themselves for life, right? Just the general mindset, and just kind of like your two-minute elevator pitch, but what is something somebody that's listening to this can just take away from your skill set and what you've been teaching and what you've been preaching? Because, you know, maybe somebody looks at the book and they're like, well, I'm not into the woods, so how is this going to be applicable? But I think every skill in there is transferable to everyday life. So, like, where do you start?
So I would tell people that the wilderness can be defined in a lot of different ways. And everyone thinks that a wilderness has to be a vast wilderness, but there are plenty of places as you drive to work that are down in ravines and creeks that are just outside of the view of the road that can pose a life-threatening emergency to you if you're trapped there, right? And these skills, even if you don't plan on spending a lot of time in the wilderness, they temper your understanding of the world when you get back to society. We are nothing more than creatures in nature, and we have to feed ourselves, we have to protect ourselves, we have to shelter ourselves, things like that. And if you understand how to do things the hard way, it makes life so much easier when things are easy and things are handed to you. So what we can do if we want to prepare ourselves for life, and this is not just for that wilderness survival thing, but it's to create a roadmap for the best possible life you can have, you need to have understanding, right? Understanding of your family's medical history, for one, right? You have to have an understanding that you are not going to live forever. So how are you going to live in your teens, in your 20s, in your 30s? You better start accepting the reality of, you know, this idea of the sands of time running out, because certain things are going to be off the table as you get older. And especially if you are not training yourself to stay physically healthy, to continue doing the things that you enjoy. You also have to realize that sometimes it's not about you. Sometimes the greater satisfaction is going to come from teaching someone to then take over for you, and you watch them succeed. So all of these skills, you're building this knowledge base, but it does no good if you keep it locked inside. Part of the reason I wrote that book is a legacy project. I want 30 years from now, someone to read that and be like, where is that guy? And I'm going to be some old dude, you know, hopefully my girlfriend, eventually my wife, you know, will be by my side, and I'll be like, oh, you're the young whippersnapper reading my book. You know, and if I say whippersnapper, come up to me and like slap me in the face and be like, you're not from the 40s. But, you know, the whole idea is like, be realistic, carry equipment that betters your life, right? I'm a big fan of the book, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And I love the idea of, you know, items can be assets or liabilities, right? And you want to carry tools on you that are assets. Maybe something is very sentimental to you. Maybe it has a lot of memories attached to it. Well, if you're not willing to use that tool to the greatest extent, well, it's not going to be a good tool. So carry proper tools. Carry tools. And then the other thing is, be willing to be a white belt in something new your entire life. Always continue studying. You know, whether you want to learn additional medical training or you want to do survival skills, you want to get into fishing. You just mentioned that you wanted to get into bow hunting. Awesome, right? Maybe you've spent your whole life shooting AR-15s. Well, maybe now it's time to drop down behind a precision rifle. Maybe you've spent your whole life doing backcountry cooking with just, you know, freeze-dried meals. Well, why not try cast iron? Like, there are so many skills that are out there, and the knowledge is free. You just have to get yourself a library card and find someone who's willing to show you firsthand if you really want that as a teacher, and you'll have the greatest life out there.
Man, I love the analogy, just be a white belt every day. And it's just take on new challenges and humble yourself and just say, hey, I don't know how to do this, but today's my day. So that's awesome, man.
I love it. And we always start wrapping things up with a quick discussion on music. And I'm putting you on the spot because I don't know that I've ever heard you reference any music ever. Books, you're always referencing books. So I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but like,
hang on, let's do.
Yeah, huh?
I didn't want to cut you off. We could do some trivia though, man. Like, if he was an '80s child, we can try to guess based on our conversation. That could be a little fun too, man. But
okay, well, you lead then, Ski. Apparently, you got a question on the brain.
I don't know, man. I mean, we need to like do the rapid fire questions, and then I can name his favorite band. But I don't know those questions yet, so. I'm sorry, man. I cut you.
So I think what Ski is saying is if you put your Walkman on and you hit play on your little Walkman, like what cassette would you have been listening to? Did you listen to music growing up?
Oh my gosh. So I went through a really awkward phase in my preteen years, like 11, 12. Yeah. For a long time, I was a big fan of Red Hot Chili Peppers and Nirvana.
Yeah,
what was the album Blood, Sex, Sugar, Magic?
Yeah, amazing album though, man.
No, it's not. No, it's
yes,
not.
It is. I'm telling you, bro. There's a time and a place for that.
I could easily play that front to back, you know. And oh my god, so I went through a weird phase where I was into like Nirvana, not so much Pearl Jam, mm-hmm. and I didn't really appreciate Stone Temple Pilots until I was older. But like, mm-hmm. I was into the grunge thing, and I wore the same flannel over and over and over, riding a mountain. I wasn't a skater. I was a mountain biker. So okay. I wore the same flannel every single day. And it was from Ocean Pacific of all companies, right? So it was pretty terrible. Now that I look back on it, it had green, actually it wasn't flannel. It had green flowers on it. It was green and black. But then I went through like 311, Ugly Kid Joe, right? Like,
yeah, man.
And then, In high school, I was listening to a little bit more retro, like The Doors, Aerosmith. I was into Steve Miller Band. And then right around that time was like when like Third Eye Blind was coming out. And then like all that kind of like poppy rock music and stuff like that. I listened to just about everything. I got into The Stones a lot. There were just a lot of different types of music. I was so eccentric with music too. Like, I would not be ashamed to say that, like, if a J-Lo song came out, I was like, hell yeah, let me listen to that thing again, you know? Like, it was catchy, right? But then as soon as that was over, it would be like DMX, right? In my freshman year in college, it was Rough Riders Anthem. Like, every night before we would go out. And then Spring Break was Motley Crue, Kickstart My Heart. Like,
gosh, man.
So all over the place.
I love this right now. Yeah. I'm just like a walk down memory lane right now. I'm trying to remember the words to Semi-Charmed Kind of Life by Third Eye Blind after you mentioned that. And nobody knows them.
No one knows the words, right?
And I can sing it, though.
Hey, but the important question is, with that flannel, did you ever tie it around your waist and wear it like, because that's how you had to wear it, right?
Yeah. So I will say this. When I was a little kid, I was way, way too chubby. Like, I had an awkward year or a bunch of years where I was just fat. Like, and I'm going to fat shame myself here. Like, when I was in the second grade, I was well over 100 pounds, right? That was like 8 or 9 years old. I was a big kid. And it wasn't until I hit puberty that I got taller and I kind of lost some of the baby weight. But yeah, I used to tie the flannel around my waist because it would hide my gut.
Okay.
So yeah, I used to do that all the time.
Look, that was the big thing. Like you said, when I was younger, actually, when I first got into punk rock in like the mid 80s, because of the Circle Jerk Skank Man, you know, that this design, everybody, you know, wore their flannel shirts around their waist. And then several years later, it becomes the big grunge thing. Fortunately, I'm at school and I'm wearing a flannel shirt. I'm in art class. I was an art nerd, right? And my brother is in art class with me, my older brother, who is just a character. Well, I get up to go get something from the front of class, and man, I feel this like cool breeze, like a little river band, man, just freaking cool breeze in the back of my ass. And I'm like, oh my God. And my brother is laughing and he's like, you ripped your pants, dude. Of course, everybody's staring at me. So now I've got to take off my flannel and wrap it and spend the rest of the day with the flannel wrapped around my waist and hope that it stays, you know, hanging down. And of course, he's telling everybody, like, yo, when you get a chance, pull up his skirt. He kept calling it my skirt. But anyway, the cool thing was at that time was like Pearl Jam was huge. Soundgarden was huge. So I looked like a, you know, just a grunge kid. But anyway, I ripped the pants. But I was messing around with Red Hot Chili Peppers earlier. I'm like the one person I think in America who, when people start talking about music and how they got into it, that I kind of badmouth the Chili Peppers. And I shouldn't do that. That was wrong.
I'll be honest, but dude. Anthony Kiedis could still kick your ass. He's getting old now, man. But that dude's in shape, man.
Yeah, I appreciate their sound. I think my problem was like bands like Fishbone and some other bands had this like great sound. And while I still listen to Fishbone, I think most people would, it was kind of like Chili Peppers seemed very influenced by them. And then they took off, and good for them though. I was just cutting up and I was joking around. No, I like that though. I always thought like, man, I wonder what this cat, what music he's listening to when he's out, like, or at least in his mind, like what you grew up listening to. So that was good.
So we can wrap the music up with this, man. If you're going out on your 48-hour survival with a Ziploc bag and you can put one CD in it today, which CD are you putting in it, man?
So this is actually a really embarrassing story, but I really don't care.
Right.
When I did the 72-hour challenge last year, I'm driving to the site and it was going to start at 7 a.m. So I'm just flipping through the channels, and out in Utah, right, there's not a lot of radio channels, and I didn't have like satellite radio or anything like that. So I'm flipping through the channels, and the last song that I heard before I did the 72-hour challenge was Dua Lipa Levitating. All right. Now for 72 hours, I kept singing that song in my head, and I was like, what the hell am I doing? You know, like, you know, glitter in the sky, glitter in my eyes. Like, I'm like, what the hell am I singing? You know, So I think when we do this next challenge, I might share a little bit of my pain with my students. I'll have my car at the next challenge, and I might blast Dua Lipa
just for what I'm talking about.
Like, let them feel what I felt, you know?
Yeah. Let it get trapped in their head. I love it, man. I love it. Ski, do you have anything else?
No, man. Just thank you so much for your time. This has been awesome. I think it's been very encouraging, and I think hopefully it's going to open some doors for some people that just – want to get out there and start getting back to their roots.
Yeah. And we didn't even get into the magazine articles you've written. You've written over 100 magazine articles. We'll post some stuff up. How can everybody find you out there?
You guys can go to fieldcraftsurvival.com. There is a contact page on fieldcraftsurvival.com with, you know, instructors and how to reach everyone. Instagram, you can find me on Instagram. It's just ESTELAWILDED, Estella Wild Ed. It was a short name for my old company. You guys can email me, Estella@FieldCraftSurvival. You guys can find me in the woods. You can find me at trade shows. I'm all over the place. And one thing I'll say real quick, you know, I am the world's worst salesman. I'm not a merchant. I'm an educator. And I'll tell you, if you come and train with me, fantastic. I'm happy. But if you find the right survival school that fits your demeanor, right? If you want someone to beat you down, go find that school. If you want someone to like have you hug trees, that's cool. I'm just happy that you guys are getting out there and you're becoming stronger. So I don't care if you train with me or you train with someone else, but just get some training and live a good life.
Perfect. Perfect. We're going to leave it on that. Disruptors out.